know anything about you.
Listen, Doc.
Quiet.
Doc.
Don't Doc, tell me anything.
Doc,
quiet.
You gotta help.
Quiet.
I'm gonna read your thoughts.
Let's see now. You come here from a great distance?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't tell me. You want me to buy a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post?
No.
Not a word. Not a word. Not a word now. Quiet. Donations. You want me to make a donation to the Coast Guard Youth Auxiliary?
Doc, I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented. Now I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
My God. Do you know what this means? It means that
welcome to Flavor Living Radio. This is Bryant, your host, here on the first week of May. We want to welcome you back. I know you guys have been enjoying our Scarf and Carf show. We want to bring a great show today. There's a word. You know, our show is called Flavor Living, as you possibly, if you've heard our show. And we try to bring food trends about chefs, cooking, and anything from the past, present, and future. But this word gastronomy, is from the words neurogastronomy and molecular gastronomy. We're talking about flavor. How do we, all of us here in America and global, have flavor with our foods? Like when we have different spices, paprika, salt, pepper. And we're eating different foods like spaghetti, sushi, roast beef. How do we know the taste of how it tastes like? How do we know that's roast beef? Well, today we're going to dive into this and find out what makes us have flavor as human beings, you know, here on planet Earth. And We're going to just kind of break it down. And first, we're going to talk about molecular gastronomy. And we have somebody who's going to kind of from England. And they're going to give us their definition of molecular gastronomy. We hope you like our show. Tune in and relax and enjoy more of the flavor.
It's a really good question, what molecular gastronomy is. I actually hold the only chair in molecular gastronomy of anyone in the world. I have an honorary post in the University of Copenhagen. And I don't really know what it is anyway. It's a name which was emerged from the media and other places to cover all sorts of things. And it sprang from some work we did a long time ago. But it's become used as a style of cooking, and chefs use it as molecular cooking and stuff like that. Those of us who are doing it actually are interested in a very simple question. What makes food delicious? Why is it that I love something but somebody else won't like it? Why do I really love a food one day but not love it another day? What is it that makes us really enjoy our food? And to understand that, you have to involve all the sciences. You need to understand where the food's grown, how it's processed, how it's harvested, how it's transported, what you do with it when you've got it in the kitchen, which is where the physics and chemistry come in, and then how it's presented on a plate, and what you do while you're eating it, who you're eating it with, where you're eating it, even what it looks like. And all these things combine to determine whether we think it's delicious or not. So we need physicists, chemists, agriculturalists, biologists, psychologists, physiologists on board. And at the end of the day, we hope we'll find out what makes food taste great. And if we can do that, then maybe we can help people eat a better diet.
So we're getting a little bit more into the definition here. You know, I look at it as like it's exploring the science of flavor. So really, I heard you need really all of your senses to come up with flavors, your sight, your taste, your smell, your hear. I couldn't believe it myself, you know. But before we continue going on, we want to go to how it was, you know, when we didn't have that much spices. You know, we didn't have the spices, the stove. So how was molecular gastronomy, how was that in tune to life back in the 1800s, the 1900s? So we're going to take a step back in time, you know, back to the future. Yes. And find out how they were cooking then. And then we're going to go back to current times, you know what I mean? Here on The Flavor. Be right back.
This is the American Gastronomy class. And the idea behind this is we're visiting the original way of how people used to cook. We didn't have tongs or utensils or olive oil or canola oil. So the challenge is we give the students duck, which has a high fat content, salmon, which is a high fat content. They utilize the Three Sisters, which are beans, corn, and squash, traditional for Native Americans. And we give them a fire pit, and they have to come up with how they're going to cook the proteins and the vegetables, but in a creative manner so that it's, you know, edible for themselves and their classmates.
These are duck kebabs with squash, zucchini, red pepper, and onion.
Yeah, it's different, but it's also, we're like, we know the method, so like converting them just without all the electricity is...
It just gets you to think on your toes a lot more.
It, like, on the fat side, it has like a really thick layer of fat, so you can leave it on the fat side so that it can cook throughout, and we keep on turning it every so often so it doesn't burn. I'm surprised on how well it's working. Yes.
You know, they're going to use basic fundamental cooking techniques. There's going to be steaming, there's going to be, you know, somewhat sauteing in fat, but they utilize rock. They have granite rocks that they've heated in their fire, so they know that if they put their duck fat side down, it's going to render the fat, so now that they have something that they can cook with, and then they can cook their other vegetables on there, they can cook their duck on there. If they roast their meats over the fire, and then the drippings will go on other things that are underneath the meats. I mean, if you look around and you'll see everybody's got a different concept. Not all students decided to use their large fire.
So right now we are reheating our rocks, cooled down a little bit with the salmon. We're going to start on our duck and our maple-soaked green beans. That's going to be pretty interesting. We're probably going to move the rocks out of the fire pit. It's a little problematic. Our tools aren't that great baking the rocks, so hopefully it works out for us.
So we pretty much created a steam chamber. So you start with hot coals, you put wet corn husks on it, you put your product wrapped in cabbage, more wet leaves, and then dirt over it, and it creates the steam of the coals. So in this cabbage, you can kind of see it. They're standing like cooking.
What are you eating?
The salmon.
Give me some.
The salmon.
Salmon.
Try a piece without the dirt.
Why do you need the butter?
This was like a New England clam bake type of technique, and we did like a stuffed cabbage with duck and corn, beans, onions.
Every day, I wouldn't like it, but it is fun for the first time. It's a lot of fun. I like this challenge.
They figured out that if they dug a smaller hole and put coals in there, they could control the heat. I mean, this whole class is about problem solving. How can they figure out how to cook the food that they've been given? Restaurant industry, you know, if the power goes out, your diners don't get up and go home. You still got to figure out how to produce your dinner and please your customers. So this is just one way to take the students out of their comfort zone, which is the kitchen, and problem solving.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay. Forever young.
can see the light surrounding you. May you always be courageous, stand upright and be strong. May you stay forever foundation when the wind changes shift. May your heart always be joyful, and may your song always be sung. May you stay.
Welcome back to Flavor Living Radio. This is Bryant. We hope you liked that song. It was called Forever Young. Very good. I mean, those words were heartfelt, those when they were singing that song. You have to look that up. Now, we're on our show called Gastronomy, Molecular Neural Gastronomy, and we're talking about how we come to the conclusion of flavor, how we come to the when we're eating and tasting spices, and we bite out of an apple, we have an apple. Or when we taste coffee, it tastes like coffee. And we're going to go more into more definition of taste on how the science and how it comes about. Please listen in and take notes, because this is really not all of us have this. All humans have this in common, similar. All backgrounds, all gender, all of this, all of us have this type of skills, the five senses to determine what tastes are coming to our from our plate. So listen and see what you think.
So now we could talk about the molecular events that give you this sense of flavor. We'll start, I think, just to be organized, if you will, then with the easier one, which is taste. Sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and umami. And those occur on your tongue. They're specialized cells that exist in various places on your tongue. Actually, I should point out that more than 90% of the tissue of your tongue has nothing to do with taste. The taste cells, the cells that are sensitive to these various tastes, occupy really a relatively small part of your tongue. But there are various sorts of either receptors or what we call channels which are able to bind to, which are able to grab a hold of things like salt, ions, sodium in particular, or sweet molecules like sugars or bitter molecules, or sourness, which is a question of what we call pH, which is due to hydrogen ions. And they're able to grab a hold of these particular kinds of particles. And when they do so, they signal through the cell, through the rest of the taste cell, they set up a change in the electrical properties of that cell. And that's what's transmitted to the brain through a somewhat complicated pathways, a series of different cells all hooked together that go to a particular portion of your brain. And when one of those cells is active, your brain says, ah, this is salty, or ooh, that's bitter, or this is a bit sour. And so that's how at least those tastes, those very basic tastes are transmitted to your brain. Now, along with that, when you chew food up, your sense of smell becomes very important. Our sense of smell is mediated by a tissue way up in the nether reaches of the nasal cavity, the way back up in our nose. It's a thin tissue, a very thin, we call it an epithelium, but that just means a very thin tissue that lines a bone way up in your nose here. And it has cells in this tissue which are sensitive to various odors. Now, there are two ways odors can make it into our nose. One is by sniffing them up. And that's done, of course, and that's how we smell things in the room or outside or here or there. But we don't have such a good sense of smell that way. Well, I should make a more careful statement. It's generally thought that humans don't have a good sense of smell, but actually we do have quite a good sense of smell when tested carefully. The biggest problem with our sense of smell is that we walk on two legs. And all the good odors are 8 or 10 inches off the ground, and we have our noses stuck up here at 5 or maybe 6 feet, if you're lucky, in the air, where we just don't come into contact with odors. And of course, we don't do certain behaviors that other animals that we think are more sensitive to smells do. I always joke that dogs are supposed to have a great sense of smell, but frankly, that greeting thing they do doesn't really look like a great sense of smell to me. I think you could do that from 10 feet away rather than putting your nose right there, as it were. But in any case, other animals are willing to put their noses where the odors are, more than we are. The one exception to that is in the area of flavor. And indeed, humans have a very, very discriminating palate when it comes to food, much more than many other animals. And the reason for that appears to be that as we chew our food, we set up a pressure gradient, an air pressure gradient, and we release the molecules in the food that are odor molecules, and they go up the back of our throat through what's called, unfortunately, a name called the retronasal pathway, which just means back of the nose, really. But in any case, this retronasal pathway takes the odor molecules that are released by chewing the food and pushes them up the back of the nose and right directly onto the epithelium in the back of your nose. And this is why we then include olfaction as part of flavor, because we get a great deal of the sense of flavor, the quality of flavor of a substance from the olfactory input. Take a jelly bean of any old flavor at all. I always find it works best with grape or cherry, but any old flavor at all will do. Hold your nose and put the jelly bean in your mouth while you hold your nose. Continue holding your nose and then chew up the jelly bean, but don't swallow it. Your sensation will be, if you think about it, will be of a kind of a gloppy sweetness. That is, your sweet receptors on your tongue will be working and you'll know it's sweet, and your feel or touch receptors all in your mouth will catch the texture of it. But it won't have any of that cherry or grape flavor. Then after you've chewed on it for a little while, and while it's still in your mouth, just open your nose and actually breathe out. It's even more effective if you breathe out. And I guarantee you that you'll be shocked to find that suddenly the flavor of grape or cherry or lime or whatever it is appears as if out of nowhere. And that, I think, is a clear demonstration that it's really in your nose that you catch much of the flavor.
Oh, welcome back to Flavor Living Radio. I got a little carried away at the jelly bean, as you guys can tell. You know, when he was talking about doing the taste test, the test the flavor of the jelly, I got carried away. As you got, you know, you heard me there. But look, we're back here on the show on Flavor, and We hope you're liking our show. You know, there's one more item I wanted to show. You know, there's a lot of chefs who are doing molecular gastronomy in many restaurants. There's a restaurant in Chicago named Moto's Restaurant. And you have to hear what they're doing. I mean, there's a three to eat there, to have a meal there, make reservations. The meal lasts between 3 to 5 hours. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, 3 to 5 hours. So it's an experience to go there. And I know there's more restaurants around the country that are trying this with the, you know, as far as the, trying this and that and making sure. Let me stop here. Let me let you listen to what they're doing at the Moto restaurant in Chicago.
When a diner comes to Moto, what we offer is a tasting menu experience. That all starts with a taste of your tasting menu. You actually eat the menu, and tonight it tastes like an Italian panini sandwich. And the reason why we do this is because we want to offer you a seamless experience anywhere from 2.5 to 5 hours long. So we're basically grabbing your attention the entire time and telling you, look, this is our vision in gastronomy, and we hope you like it. I would describe the cuisine as shocking yet tasty. And also working with NASA, you might want to call it intergalactic cuisine, but that might be a stretch. Here at Moto, all of the chefs are actually servers, and this is because you're going to have many questions on how things are prepared. If they're not patent-pending technologies, then we will explain exactly how things are done. So they're very knowledgeable about the food because every dish requires an explanation. One of the things that you might experience here, we call pancakes made tableside, where we take pancakes and puree them into a cooked pancake batter. We place that into a syringe and then inject that onto a frozen plate tableside. So the pancake batter, which is cooked, actually freezes into a cooked frozen pancake. We flip it over, place it on a spoon with maple syrup, and then you consume this. Another example is our printed food, where I can print up a picture of, say, cotton candy, and we actually have this on our menu, and it looks and tastes like cotton candy. You know, your brain is telling you, this can't possibly be food. I'm about to eat a photo of cotton candy. And then once you eat it, it's very intense.
This laser is a class 4 laser, and what that means is that it's an infrared wavelength, which is why we're wearing the sunglasses. What we're going to use this laser for is a food and wine pairing. The food is going to be a vapor extracted from a freeze-dried orange powder. And the wine will go into the glass that the vapor is trapped in, and it's going to create a very rich, sort of caramelized orange quality in the wine.
When I think of molecular anything, I'm thinking of subatomic particle analysis, nuclear magnetic resonance machines. The only place that I've ever seen that in the food world is our project with NASA, where we're working on a three-dimensional food printer. I would say that this is more of just playful food. When we start seeing things go to Mars, then we're getting into molecular gastronomy and breaking down food to its subatomic state.
Those are in no way, shape, or form anything like Dippin' Dots.
But better.
That was our show here on Flavor, and we hope you liked as we explored the science of flavor. Yes. Tune in next week for more of our show about cooking on Flavor Living Radio, and make sure you're safe and have a great week. Thank you.
restaurants and recipes with adventures too.